report on the student and the students at midterm, and we'll figure out how well he's doing or not as we go along. Some years ago, we had a graduate student with Charlie Gaskins at Washington State who worked on survival analysis in an experimental population we had at Miles City that really shed some light, for me at least, on a couple of different approaches to ways that we might consider longevity and a functional longevity. And this progress report is headed in the direction of a national cattle evaluation for longevity, if you will, or sustained reproductive success, using data from the American Hereford Association. And what I want to do is I want to walk you through the process, and I want hopefully to engage you in the discussion, because it seems like once we put those evaluations up, they get cast in stone pretty quickly. And I just as soon put the best one I can do up to start with. And I know that collectively we're a heck of a lot smarter than me. So, philosophically, I want to define success as the female that calves every year. And that seems to have some intuitive appeal. It also, I think, a lot is a feasible thing for us to do if we use whole herd reporting and we use the data from whole herd reporting to the greatest degree that we can. So the data source here is the American Hereford Association database. They've been on whole herd reporting now for about 8 years. The paradigm that I'm going to lay out certainly requires whole herd reporting, and it also is going to require from the Hereford Association animals to be in a yearling weight contemporary group. And I'm going to use yearling weight contemporary group as a way to identify sets of heifers that have been raised together going into this. All of the females that enter into this analysis calve as heifers. So it's not a heifer pregnancy sort of an analysis. The analysis that Dan Mosier is engaged in doing at K-State is complementary to this, in the sense that he's working on the heifer piece, and I'm working on after that. I've used the data then to calculate age at calving every time a female calves, and then to calculate the intercalving period, just as the difference between those ages. There's almost 50,000 heifer records. Female records that calved as heifers that start this process in the seven to eight years that AHA has been doing whole herd reporting. So a fairly sizable data set accumulating fairly quickly. As I said, yearling weight groups give me heifers that I'm assuming were raised together. And they're going to be bred at some point after that. But there's also some things that we've done. Our extension folks, Jason Ohola, who I was giving a hard time a minute ago, or a few minutes ago, about traits, and others have recommended that we breed heifers ahead of the cow herd so that they have a longer postpartum interval and a chance to get bred back. And in this analysis, we've tried to allow that flexibility. So there's an age at first calving group for those whose age at first calving is less than about 700 days. So that's roughly 23 months. There's the second age at first calving group then that is 700 to 839 days, which is sort of the age range of the typical calved at 2 years of age group. and then there's a group that calves at about 2.5 years of age, and a group that calves first at 3 years of age. And, you know, the purist in me would just love to get rid of A3 and A4, those other two groups, because I believe that, you know, to be efficient as a beef producer, you probably ought to calve at 2 years of age or ahead of that. But there's a significant part of the data that resides in those groups. And those folks who do that as a management strategy choose to do it because they think it's the right strategy. And I don't think from the standpoint of a breed association we can just say, get lost. So the first piece of contemporary group then becomes this age at first calving group concatenated with the yearling weight contemporary group. And it defines a group of females that start the process together. But we also have the capability to account for what I'm going to call a time-dependent herd year season effect. So I have cows of various ages in a given herd who all calve in the spring, who all have different opportunities for success. And so I also need to account for that second time-dependent effect in this analysis. And it creates then some pretty nice opportunities to account for environmental circumstances. If the drought occurs in 2005, all the heifers or all the females of whatever age they're in the herd experience that drought at the same time. And that contemporary, that effect needs to be accounted for in some way. So we took that data set, that 47,000 and some record data set, and went through that, and there's some heifers that calve at less than 600 days of age, or so the data say. And we did give those the heave-ho. Those are heifers that are bred first, probably while they're still nursing the cow, or there are errors in the data. There's also age at first calving at something substantial, in many cases, or some cases, substantially more than 3 years of age. There's one I remember whose first calving is at 5,000 days. Now, exactly how she got to stay that long, I don't know. We also edit out of the data those heifers that are transferred before they calve the first time. So I have the list of transfers from the Herd Association. And after we impose that set of three edits, we're down to about 40,000 records. We're going to do this with in the analysis. We're going to remove sires who have less than three daughters, and that takes another 3,000 or so out. And then we're going to remove the yearling contemporary groups that have only one animal in them. And I was quite surprised that there's 5,000 of those groups. That seems to me to be a very large number of yearling contemporary groups that are comprised of one female. But we're going to, so the philosophy again then is a female that's successful is one that he has every year. So coming into this then, success can take on a value of one, and everybody gets a one because everybody in the analysis gets a one because they calved at, they had a first calf. So then to get your success score from the female to get her success score from one to two, if she's bred to calve ahead of the cows initially, or the assumption is that she's bred to calve ahead of the cows and has an first inter-calving period of less than 455 days, then she's successful. That's giving her back that month ahead of the cows to make her two, and then 425 days. And then everybody else has to have a first inter-calving period of 425 days. 425 days is simply 365 plus three heat cycles. 60 days. And my assumption here in success is that if you don't get bread within three heat cycles after you've had a year, you're not going to be successful. You're not going to be able to maintain annual calving. After that, to increment your success score, you have to calve within. You have to have success at the previous time point and calve again within 425 days. And currently, at the time I got the data, the maximum number of calvings was 7, so the maximum success score is 6. So the data take on this discrete number of classes, numbers 1, 2, 6. In survival analysis, we can do something called censoring. And censoring is simply making a statement that this record, to the best of our knowledge, is incomplete. When we did stayability and Warren's here in the room, I think, and Warren Snelling and Bruce Golden started that process, there was this lag that they had to deal with because we couldn't give an animal a record until she was 5. In this sort of modeling of the data, we use censoring to account for that, so we can have a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old that's in the data set, and we're simply saying her record's incomplete. Females that are censored, if they were successful through 2008, we have no reason to believe they're not going to be successful in 2009. It's a censored record, whatever the number is for success. We also censor those records who have an intercalving period reported that's less than gestation length. And there's some of those. I don't know quite how you get it done, but there are some. And, you know, if it represents a premature parturition of some sort, the female did what we asked her to. She got pregnant in terms of reproducing. My guess is that most of those really, though, are nothing more than somebody made an error, key punching the data. And I don't want to penalize that female for somebody made an error punching the data in. When you start looking through these data sets, one of the things that you quickly come to realize is that dates sometimes get funny numbers. Dams of ET calves. At the time that a female has an ET calf reported, we censor her record. So that those ET females that breeders believe were really good, I mean, they invested in them pretty heavily, we give them credit for the success up to that point, and then we treat them as censored, and we also treat as censored those females that were successful at the time they were transferred to another program. So what does this data look like? The table at the top then gives you success scores, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and whether or not they're censored. So there's 14,000, almost 600 females that have a success score of 1, and roughly a third of those are censored records. That is, they had, and for the most part, that's they had their first calf in 2008. Two-thirds of those are not censored, however. They had one calf and failed. Didn't get bred back. And you go across to the success scores of 6, which at this point is the maximum possible in the data set. And almost all of those cows that have had their 7th calf are censored records. There's only a few of those that actually failed at that point. In this data set, given the specification, There's 5,042 yearling contemporary groups. There's a little over 3,300 sires, and those sires are represented by 6.5 effective daughters each. So there isn't a large number of daughters per sire. If I were to do an analysis of stayability to five, there'd be 16,500 records, and the average, there'd be 43% of those that would have been successful in a stayability to five. And in that data set, there'd be 2,100 sires represented. So by doing the survival analysis, or using the survival analysis approach, I have a little more data that I can use, and I have maybe a third again as many sires as if I were to do the stayability to five sort of analysis. The pedigree that I'm using at this point in time looks like this. All these females have a sire, paternal grandsire, paternal granddam, and the paternal grandsire has a sire and a dam, and the paternal granddam has a sire as well. And I'm using this abbreviated pedigree at least at this point in time, simply for tractability of the analysis. When I get more experience with the process, we may expand the pedigree, but in any case, those animals that are further back in this pedigree than what I'm showing don't contribute a great deal to relationship between the sires that are actually being evaluated. So we're going to model success. We're going to use a public domain tool. The tool is the Survival Kit. It's a turnkey set of software that's been pretty well used around the world. It's done problems as large as North American Holstein with some 10 million animals evaluated. So don't think 50 or 60,000 records is going to tax it very much. It's been used in lots of shops. We're going to use procedures that are customized for discrete failure times. So, and yes, the maximum that I have presently is six, but at least in the things that I've looked at, it suggests to me that you can have maybe 18 or 20 classes of discrete failure time, and the approach is still very tractable. A unique feature of this analysis then is that time-dependent contemporary grouping, so that I can account for the fact that this group of females all were exposed to the circumstances in this particular herd in a particular year and season. It's a sire model, it's not an animal model, and that's a difference between the stayability sort of approach and the survival analysis approach. Survival analysis is not very tractable in an animal model context, but we both have relationships. We use A inverse. The survival analysis allows for data censoring, as opposed to we just have to leave you out, and so that has some appeal. Now I would point out that out of this analysis, we get a survival curve for a sire, and it's fairly simple to take off of that survival curve a value that is exactly analogous to stayability. We could in fact, if we chose, present the results in units that are stayability. We could present the results in units that are number of successes or expected number of successes with a few decimals added onto it, so that in an economic analysis you'd have something that looked like a longevity kind of number as to how far you might expect females to persist in your herd before they had to be replaced. I've not come to any decisions about the way this will ultimately be expressed, and in fact, probably the way it's ultimately expressed is more dependent on what the board of directors of the American and the staff of the Hereford Association want to express it as than what I want to express it as. And there's good reasons for a variety of different expressions. With that, I think I'm going to take questions, Mark. In the back. Yes, it's the same. It's the same thing as there's lots of names you could call it, but it's the same thing as calving interval. Why do I allow the flexibility of something that's longer than 365 days? Because getting pregnant at a single service is to some extent a chance event, and I think we all know that it's one opportunity is probably not enough. Otherwise, we'd all have 22-day breeding seasons. And what I'm trying to do is reflect, if you will, the annual breeding season that would exist on an operation. And that breeding season typically would run from a few days less than to 60 or 80 days beyond a year. Yes. No, I am talking about individual cows. Each individual cow in that system gets the opportunity. Now, if she's really late, you know, we both know what the answer to this is. If she's really late this year, if she has an intercalving period that's 424 days, so she gets success this time, her chances of being successful next time aren't very good. Lauren?
You know, like in a lot of our data, you'll see producers who will take the whole herd and change season. And, you know, so then you'd have to maybe have to do something with those as well.
I've not noticed. I'm not going to say it didn't happen. I'm going to say I'm ignorant. I've not noticed that phenomenon. I've noticed certainly individual females that change calving seasons, and my assumption is that those females failed. They didn't get bred to calve again in the spring, and so they got shifted over to the fall season. And but that is worth looking at. I mean, if the whole herd in a given year suddenly makes this big leap, then they probably need to get handled as some sort of a special case.
Yeah, because we've been seeing quite a bit of that, you know, with drought in certain areas. You know, they'll maybe change seasons just because of feed resources. So.
Appreciate that.
Oh, great. The way I'm understanding it is if a cow misses a year, so she's had three calves, misses a year, comes back and has two more calves, she's censored, right?
No, she's failed.
I mean failed.
When she failed to calve in that fourth year,
then she's out.
Failed.
Okay.
That's as long as she was only succeeding as long as she calved every year.
Okay.
She isn't dead.
Right.
But she's failed. It's right behind you.
I was just curious as to how you split up your contemporary groups, as to why it was the 700 days that calving was considered earlier, if it was less than that, if after they calved the first time, they were given the three cycles to, I mean.
I actually looked at the data and looked at the distribution of ages when they calve. And it's this four-peak phenomenon, if you will. And I made a rather executive decision that we're going, obviously we're going between these peaks, but the particular, the 700 is a matter of absolute convenience on my part. Nothing more. It's like 700's down in the valley, and that's a nice number.
And just one more real quick. You said that you removed animals that the sires weren't or didn't have at least three daughters
right.
within a contemporary group. What about sires across those herds?
Sires can, it's not within a contemporary group. The sire restriction is across the data set.
Okay.
So it's three daughters in the whole data set, wherever they show up at.
If I understand correctly, you said success until the ICP was less than gestation length. Was that?
If the intercalving period is reported in the data is less than gestation length, then I simply censor the record at that level, whatever the current value of success is.
And so was gestation length calculated from a subset of this data then?
No. It's just me assuming that gestation is about 280 days.
So it doesn't allow for any variation in gestation length?
No. But if I have a calf, but if I have two calves, they have birth dates 160 days apart. I know that's less than gestation length. I don't care.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's really very few. There's essentially no animal that gets caught on the 280-day kind of value. There's animals in the data set that have birth dates that are 70 to 180 days apart.
So there's not a 270 and you make that call or
okay. No.
The other thing, would it be possible to penalize animals based on the ICP so that you can give more credit to a female that is able to conceive in that first 21 days versus one that's in the second versus one that's in the third?
You could certainly attempt to make this scale continuous in terms of survival. And we did that a little with Phoenix Rogers' efforts earlier. At this point, it seems to me that that's a lot of work for not much benefit, because you still have this very tightly grouped set of values. They aren't quite the same number, but they're real tight. And whether I call them 2 or I call them 1.8, 1.9, 2, 2.1, 2.2, 2.3, and then I jump all the way to 3. I don't think there's much value there in terms of the genetic evaluation.
How do you compare cows? Say one cow has had one calf and she's in the system now, and another calf has had 4 or 5 calves and then failed. Is she more successful than the one that's
yes.
only had one opportunity?
Yeah, the one that has had two calves and is censored gets credit for having had the two calves, but no more. The one that fails at with a success of 5 gets credit for the success of 5, which equivalently is saying she got credit for being successful 1, 2, 3, 4. So she gets more credit.
Any more questions? Not, I'll butt in. I've got a question for you. Maybe I should be asking the the producers in the audience, but if you, in your perfect world, you've done a lot of decision support, Brian Brigham's done a lot, and we have to transform a stayability EPD to develop an age distribution of a herd. In your perfect world, how should longevity EPDs be expressed? On what scale? And again, maybe I should be asking all the breeders, would you want it in days or number of calves? Or?
We collectively have preached for a long time we ought to cull open cows. Seems like that's part of our dogma. Whether it's really good advice or not, it seems like it's part of our dogma. So I would like to know how long she persists in my herd, what my age distribution looks like, my herd's age distribution looks like, if I follow that sort of recommended advice. The most efficient situation is the situation where cows calve every year. So I want the age distribution under the situation where cows calve every year. When we try to do an index, a set of economic values for the stayability trait, we oftentimes, I'm not going to say always, but we oftentimes back transform that into an age distribution under a set of assumptions that say we culled, that the reason that stayability is the number it is because we culled a bunch of open cows to get there. And the assumption is that that's how those cows disappeared. So, this, I mean, in my world, it's in the units of time. But I don't know that, I raised the question, is RFI the right trait? And that's, I mean, you're asking me what the right trait is. And I don't know that this is the right trait. Okay? But I want to put out, this is one way to think about this process so that more than just me rattles around what is the right trait. Because I guarantee you, after you've produced the genetic evaluation for 3 years, you aren't changing the trait.
I'll agree that you would, once you release an EPD, you usually don't change the units, or it's very painful if you do. So if I'm understanding you right, Mike, if you were calculating indexes or using these EPDs to calculate an index or specialize mm-hmm. an index, we've had this discussion on the indexes, time is an easier expression to put an economic weight to.
I actually get out of the survival analysis a probability distribution associated with success on the x-axis. So I can actually pick off of that distribution any number I want. I could use the whole distribution, which is an age distribution of those animals, or it's an age distribution of those animals that were successful in the index calculation. I have that flexibility to do that. Or I can code it, I can code it and say, okay, I want the probability you were successful at 5. And that's what I'm going to report. I can pull that value off of that, out of that analysis straight away. So there are alternatives in terms of the units of reporting.
Thanks.
On this analysis, do we have to have a certain number of the cows fail in order to allow us to come up with a survivability?
No. If I interpret the question right, you're asking, in a contemporary group, does there have to be variance? Does there have to be failures? And the answer to that is no. So for instance, the small group of 8 animals that all have success values of 2 and are censored are just fine. They can enter into the analysis. Clear in the back.
A little back. I'm working on it.
For those of us out here in California, we've got a abortion disease that's we're not going to get rid of. It's called epizootic bovine abortion or foothill abortion. And it's not uncommon in a herd to lose anywhere from 5 to 20% of the calves from heifers, and maybe later in the animal's life they'll lose another calf as they lose their immunity to the particular bacteria that causes this. So how do we judge the success of those animals? And the ones that abort are the ones you do not want to get rid of, because they'll at least be immune for a couple of years. And so that creates a kind of a bookkeeping problem for purebred breeders, because you may not get the entire truth on the reporting.
I think this approach actually maybe works to their benefit a little bit. If they report that calving, that abortion, that premature parturition, it's going to get trapped, presumably, in the less than gestation length kind of edit for intercalving period. And those records are going to get treated as censored. Now, if it's a 2-year-old heifer and it's her first calving, she isn't going to enter into the analysis necessarily at that point, depending on how that gets handled ultimately. I've not figured that piece of it out, and that's kind of that's one of those things that's in the window between Dan Mosier and myself. Dan's doing the heifer pregnancy kind of development process. How does she end up with a heifer pregnancy the way that I think the way Dan? Dan here.
He's speaking
okay,
next door.
Then, thanks. Then I don't want to misquote Dan, but I think the way Dan is approaching heifer pregnancy is a calving date as a heifer. So does she get into Dan's analysis? I can't speak to that. If she has a calving date that's really odd, she's going to get kicked out of mine as being an oddity and edited out. And I don't know how to deal with that. We have a similar problem in eastern Montana. It's attributable to ponderosa pine. And I recognize that problem exists, but I don't know exactly how to deal with it.
Since you're, talking about developing that part of the program, another scenario that I get presented with, and it was the advice I give to ranchers is based on a paper I read a few years ago that talked about the 4 to 8 year age range being the most productive lifetime of a cow, and that if you have a heifer who has calved successfully as a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old, and then as a 4-year-old is open, it may be more economically viable to retain her as an open cow rather than retaining a heifer who has never calved before, in view of the fact that a cow or heifer may have problems calving, and this 4-year-old probably won't. You already know that part of the equation is taken care of. So we've used that strategy successfully in commercial herds to go ahead and retain the 4-year-olds and cut down on the amount of replacement heifers that were being kept.
No real argument. I mean, that's an individual producer's decision. My comment is that if we accept my philosophy about success, calves every year, then she still failed, even though the decision, the economic decision, is to keep her. That's fine. I'm not saying you have to cull her. I'm simply saying that. To create a genetic evaluation that reflects reproduction as a trait, we need to have the trait definition reflect successful reproduction. and she did fail. Now, to keep her, that economic decision, that's a different kettle of fish.
Any more questions?
To make sure I understand this, you're basing your idea on a calf born or a calf that makes it to the marketplace and puts a dollar in my pocket?
I'm basing it on a calving date.
Okay, so if the calf dies 2 weeks later, she's still successful?
She was successful in reproducing.
Okay.
And that's what we're trying to create at this point. So yes, she gets credit for, and in another sense, if it's her fault the calf died, then she got away with something.
Mike, did you make a sensor for cows that became recips within a herd? Still calved regularly, but as recips?
No. I have no way to know who those cows are, actually.
Through Herford Association, you mark a cow when she calves as a recip.
I need to look at my data and make sure that's there, that's actually there in the data set. But no, I don't think I have any recips in the data, actually. I think those are pulled off in a separate file by Stacy before I ever got there. But I'll bring that up with Stacy and Jack, because I'm not absolutely certain the answer to the question. And if that's the case, the way I would treat that recip, at least at this point, is at the time she becomes a recip, she probably is censored too. I think it's a manageable thing. I just don't know how to deal with it in the data that I have necessarily. There's in the survival analysis, that's taken into account. There's no bias per se, no statistical bias in that context.
Mike, do you think that they're going to revise that survival kit to do an animal model rather than just do a sire model? Because in this day and age, you know, computationally, there should be no problem with
It's my understanding that the survival analysis methodology is not tractable for an individual animal model. That is the basic math doesn't work well at that level. Unlike the mixed model equations. Oh no. I guess, Lauren, my thought is that if I have breeding values for the sire, maternal grandsire, and the the grand maternal sire, I can construct an index of those breeding values that will give me any animal with essentially the same accuracy that I can get out of that individual animal's own record.